brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Ronnie, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very well, sir. Very well. Thank you for having me on.
Good stuff. I really appreciate you coming on. Obviously, I want to talk about Mantic and everything and not Games Workshop in the old days, but I can't help but mention this because I've been reading some old White Dwarf magazines, and it was issue 221, just coincidentally, the other night. You appeared in a battle report, and they introduced you as a man who famously won a GW fancy dress contest dressed as a 12-sided dice. Could you talk to us a wee bit about that?
Fake news, I say. Fake news. It's Stallard, Mr. Stallard, one-man agenda. So, there's far more terrible stories out there. I think I went to a Fighting Fantasy, which when those books first came out, I think dressed as Barbarian, which involved a sword that I'd got in Spain. And then you're allowed to take swords on aeroplanes, unbelievably, dressed in, and towels was the rest of the dress. So I think they should have gone with that story, but I was never creative enough to make anything as clever as a 12-sided dice. But
Well, it made for a good story. And
exactly. Do not let the truth get in the way of a good story. I say to people that you can't have played Warhammer for longer than I did, because I had a pre-order in for the very first version of it that came out. And I had it on the day it was launched. And, I've been wargaming ever since. So, it's a record that goes back quite a long way these days.
Yeah, I mean, I want to kind of catch up with the latest from Mantic in this episode. I'm interested in just starting out with the kind of origin stories of Mantic, those early days where, you made this decision to form the company. What were your thought process at the time? What were kind of your ambitions and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, probably a little bit of leaving GW and a little bit of wanting to do something else, seeing there was something else that I thought might be needed doing. So I think the leaving GW bit was the first, I started with those guys in the early 80s in terms of buying the Warhammer stuff and the Citadel miniatures, which were fantastic. I'd been doing historical war games even before that. So it was something deeply ingrained in me, clearly some kind of lunatic gene. And during the 80s, late 80s, and when I was at uni, I worked in the stores. I'd worked at trade before I went to uni. And when I came back, it was just a real fun, exciting, expansive place to work. They'd just been bought off Brian, and the team were opening retail stores. And I came in and started sorting trade sales out. And, we grew that multiple times over, from a few million to 10 million, 12 million. I started, ran Germany. I came back, ran the UK, ended up running the studio and all the new products. And sorry about that. And it was great fun. And then slowly but surely, they kind of had been on the stock market for a while. The Lord of the Rings did great, but then slowed down. And it became a little bit corporate. They were bringing a lot of people in from Boots and other organizations. It's all becoming layered, and how much carpet you can get in the corner of your office, and do you get a corner office, or I was like, oh, come on, really? That's the extent of our ambitions. And I think when it declined and the company had to borrow money, I think some of the ambition amongst the senior management team went away, and their takeout was, well, look at that. You see, we went up to 150 million turnover, and then we've come back down to 120 million from 80 going into Lord of the Rings. So clearly licensed games don't work. And my view was, well, it kind of looks like you grew 70 million and still ended up £40 million bigger than you were when you started. Maybe you just shouldn't have spent all the money you got. And so I thought, no, I think people might want other things. I think, let's not kid ourselves. Warhammer, old world as it was then, and 40K were two exceptional franchises. Very good fun. I mean, I think the choice to blow one of them up was somewhat interesting, but I think they were phenomenal. It's eating steak, but if you eat steak every single day, sometimes you want pizza, sometimes you want Chinese, and sometimes you want Italian. And so it's got me to thinking that maybe there was other games out there and other franchises that could be explored and other ways of playing. And as I was getting older, I was starting to think about how complex and impenetrable some of the games had got. And I was just thinking that, you know, I quite like having fun while I'm playing, and genuine fun. And that was something that was starting to kind of culminate in my mind. And you'll see some of the early releases we put out were centered around those kind of thoughts. So it was both a wanderlust on my point. I like the excitement. I like the craziness of it. My wife has never forgiven me for it, obviously, giving up a nice corporate job. But I thought there was other stories that deserved to be told. And it got to the point where staying wasn't what I wanted to do, and going and trying and telling them was where we were at.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that there's a few things to kind of unpack there. Like, you seem to have found a really good place in the hobby, a really good niche for, there's the licensed stuff, which I want to get into, but also boxed games and you know, a game like Kings of War, obviously, that's a pure hobbyist game. But like a game like Dungeon Saga, you know, the type of game that somebody could get out with their partner who's not a war gamer and still play it and still enjoy it, and they're both getting something from it. So that seems like that was important to you even in those early days.
Yeah, very much. And there's a couple of things there, which was both that we all forget how hardcore games we are. And when you've been playing it for 40 years or 20 years or 30 years, and our hobby, it's a kind of a thing we go off and do. We go up to our dungeon, or basement or attic, and paint soldiers. It's quite an isolationist thing. And two things have happened to me since we've done Magic. Always I wanted to be more fun. I used to enjoy Warhammer, but it gave me a headache. You know, I was tired after one game of Warhammer. I didn't play it very often, so of course people played it there. But when we did Kings of War, I wanted a game you could take out and play. Like, and the rules were the same 3 months later and 6 months later. And of course, I'm a lunatic, and you know, Apocalypse in GW was one of my products. That was one of the things that I made, the Baneblade. And so when I made Kings of War, I wanted to be able to play those level of games. You know, really just get all your soldiers out, have a 10,000 point game on a Sunday, start, finish, and be in the pub for, you know, last orders at 8 o'clock type thing. So there were certain things that I wanted to simplify and make cleaner. And I think that's, you know, working with Alessio on Kings of War did that. But as my kids got older and I realised that Kings of War, unless they really got the bug, like we have the bug, wasn't something I could share with them, things like Dungeon Saga started to become the games that I could show off my hobby, and I could enjoy it as hobby time, but I could also enjoy it as family time. And I think probably the best example of that is Worms, because Worms has a lovely 1990s nostalgia about it. The plastic minis are gorgeous and cute. And to the uninitiated, it looks exactly like a board game. I have little boards and little meeples on top of it. But it's a war game. I'm shooting at you, you're shooting back at me, and I'm going to use different weapons to do it. All right, we've taken army list building out because you draw a card. There's a random element to it. And of course, because it's Worms, it always goes spectacularly wrong, and your best perfect plans mean your air missile drops, you know, your airstrike drops on you and everything else. Your holy hand grenade blows yourself up. But what it allowed us to do is, it's the first game I could come home and my brother-in-law and his sons came over and I had my sons out and I said, right, for 2 hours, we're going to play this board game. And I saw my brother-in-law roll his eyes, got 8 board games, and they all had a good time. They all rolled the dice. They understood the basic mechanics. And I got to share some of our hobby with people who don't do our hobby. You know, it doesn't mean, you know, it's not life-changing. They're not all now playing, you know, 15,000 point epic scale battles, but they just had a good time. And they had a good time in the, you know, in the essence of our game, minis, dice was out. It was good fun. So, from Dungeon Saga Origins is exactly the getting started with your family partner gaming group that have coming from Catan or from somewhere else that want to just dip in but actually play. And I think that's one of the things that's really key about what we're trying to do. We're trying to make games that people want to not spend all their time painting and think they're going to play, actually playing. Get it out to the club, pop it out. Right, guys, there's 10 adventures in here. Over the next 10 weeks, we're going to do that. Then we'll do something else.
Mm.
And then 3 months later, we did the Undead Adventures in Dungeon Saga Origins. Now let's do the goblins and greed, whatever, the glitter of greed. And you can think we enjoyed that. Someone sets it up, and I think just bringing our hobby out into the light is quite good fun. It's quite exciting.
Did you know that you could sponsor the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast for as little as $23 an episode? If you've got a game, product, Kickstarter, miniature range, British Chain Pub or Bee Gees album that you'd like to get in front of an audience of passionate hobbyists, then give me a shout at hello@bedroombattlefields.com. That's hello@bedroombattlefields.com. And now, back to the show. With the IPs and the licenses, what are some of the challenges and considerations when you're creating a game with that pre-existing IP?
Yeah, and what I found when I first started going for these, so we started with Kings of War in 2025, that kind of all of a sudden reared up. 2015, that had reared up. But by that point, we were doing Dreadpool, which was a great game. We'd done a Warpath Universe game, a sci-fi game, which we hadn't done very well and didn't really work. And then we started doing Kickstarters. And that was really where we were able to start accessing funds for tooling, Kings of War in a big way. We tried some different materials and Dead Zone, which was very popular in terms of the concept, if not the delivery. But it started to de-risk some of these things. We were always talking about getting into licenses. And what I found was that there's tons of great licenses out there, things we all love. But A, some of the big ones had been done. And B, a lot of the others were a good license, but there wasn't a miniatures game in it. And so the hard thing first up was finding something that was a miniatures game. Now, we did Mars Attacks, which was our first one, and it was very successful on Kickstarter. I think the gameplay wasn't quite as slick as it could have been and not quite as fun as it should have been. But it was a great learning experience in terms of interacting with licensors and licensees and a great fun IP. Walking Dead came next, and that really was a huge success, both on the Kickstarter and then at retail. We'd learned a lot from the first time. The game was much better, very, very kind of oppressive and true to the IP. You know, those zombies walkers were truly frightening. And if you caused too much ruckus, they were just whelming you and hoarding you down. So we were really getting good by this point at taking the essence of the IP and creating a game experience around it. And I think that would have gone on to be kind of a bigger game had it not been for I don't even remember, there was a season where the Seasons TV, now we had the comic license, but it was definitely carrying all before it. And then all of a sudden the TV ratings fell off a cliff and everyone said, oh, we've had enough of this. And it was bizarre and I'd never seen it. And I think it's happened again with Game of Thrones from what I saw. You know, the first five seasons were brilliant and then the two Hollywood seasons. And it's amazing when the geeks leave, everything stops, you know, when we think, nah, this isn't what we signed up for. But by that point, I think we'd got Hellboy coming down the pipeline. And this was one where I think we got it really right. We made a board game dungeon crawler rather than a war game. And you forget things like this. The four heroes in the base game, Liz and Johan, Abe and Hellboy, in the comics, never met. They're all good guys. They all partnered up with Hellboy at different times. But what you've got is an IP has to allow you to have the same, the good guys all together at some point doing something. You know, in The Walking Dead, there's certain characters that are dead before others are introduced. But in a game situation, you need access to everyone and you build your force or you go and do your adventure and we needed four good guys and here's a few other good guys. So you've got to find an IP that is willing to allow you to not just retell the story, because that would be boring, but at the same time give you enough respect that you will respect their IP and you will treat it that these are good guys and they behave this way, those are the baddies and they'll behave that way. And and we will create an atmosphere and a occasion that feels true to the original franchise. And I think we're getting, pretty good at that in understanding the IP and delivering it. And, you know, then after Halo, we had a couple of years with Umbrella Academy that got the show, didn't really work before, you know, Halo is kind of now the start of our new wave of the engaging with the IPs. And, you know, I think we've created something there that is, well, it's probably a combination of all four things we've been working for 15 years. You know, it's a real, it's true to the IP. People have said to me, God, it feels like a computer game, which I think is a wonderful thing because it has the excitement of a computer game, which I think is probably the most exciting entertainment we can get. In terms of, you know, it's coming at you and it's, you know, knockout stuff. Yet it's a social game. You're playing it with your buddies. You're rolling dice. There's the element of chances within it. Visually, it looks stunning. You know, you can paint your miniatures up if you want. You can just play them as they are. And yet it's also welcoming. There is no army building in those first boxed games. We took points out. You get four Spartans, I get four Spartans. If you want to be, you know, smart, get the Spartan edition and you can choose which four you play with and I'll choose which four I play with. But you've got four and I've got four and we've balanced them all up. So essentially it's more like a game of chess. Yes, you have pawns and you have rooks. It's not quite as dramatic as that, but you've got four and I've got four and the stat lines are the same and the weapons are rough. Do you want a bit more armor piercing? How are you going to use him? So you start getting the tactical decisions, but without having to go, should I take a Brew of Strength? Should I take a champion or a commander? And you're not having to make those decisions. Get four, play with four. And if you want to, you know, play the Recon edition, my four and your four are the same. Just yours are red and mine are blue. So who plays best and rolls best is probably going to win. But those two aren't always the same thing. So it's really welcoming. It's fun. It's that idea that I've seen a lot of people going, I finally got my partner to play a game. Now, you know, do I think they're going to turn into, you know, 27,000 point epic scale players? Probably not. But you're having fun with our games, with them. It's a social aspect and showing off a little bit of what we do. And then you can go away and paint them and build the terrain and come back a few weeks later. And you know, we're hoping that this is both going to be a wonderful casual game and a super competitive tournament game because it's got everything for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like we've already talked about the box game approach of being able to play with a partner or that. You've got that. And then also these licenses, it's, you know, people might be into that IP and they've never played a quote-unquote war game before. Yeah. You know, a Halo fan, a Walking Dead fan. And also, like you're saying, maybe most of them aren't going to go on to build a 6'4" table and build all their own scenery, but they might be into the hobby to an extent. And some of them also might, you know, go all the way. So it's just, I like this. You know, you're growing the hobby.
And they do. And, you know, you're introducing people that have, you know, in the UK, it's probably hard to grow up and not bump into a Warhammer store. But in the US, that's not been true. You know, you simply not sure. There's tons of people out there in the US that have played Halo, love kind of sci-fi and guns and grenades and killing aliens. And then they discover this game, they start playing it, and then they go like, you know what, this is my hobby. This is what I want to do. And we're seeing people, you know, coming in that way. And we assume that everyone knows what this crazy stuff that we do is. And the reality is there's lots of people out there that don't. And us being able to put that in front of them and encourage them and show them all the wonderful aspects of what we do in our hobby is recruiting people in.
How does it work? This is a complete layman's question, but getting a license to make a game, I'm assuming you don't just fire off a random email to, you know, Walking Dead or Halo or whatever. Like, how does something like that come about?
Yeah, it takes a long time. I think it felt like I was going on a jolly when I first did it. So I had someone who introduced me to someone who knew people in the US. So I went over either before or after a Gen Con show and spent 4 or 5 days in LA. So how glamorous. And this chap introduced me to Sean Kirkman from The Walking Dead. who was their licensing guy, and a few others, some of which were like, no, thank you, we've already got one. But what you start realizing is it's a network, and you start going to some licensing shows, and you go along to the shows, and you know, the first time you might not get past the secretary, but you get a card, and then a card, you call them up before. And it's just a long, hard process. The Halo deal, to get that license, took about 8 years. I was typing in, you know, Halo presentation last year, looking for one that I'd just done and was going to take somewhere. And it went through all, you know, your OneDrive folder. And you mean this Halo presentation from 2017? I was like, ah, no, I didn't. But that's, okay. Yeah, it really was that long. And that was when I was pitching to them at the shows. And things just need to align. You know, we're having conversations all the time. And you need something that's, you know, commercially viable. You know, the tooling costs can be huge on these, the development costs of the game can be big, so you've got to be pretty confident that it's going to be around for a while. It's got to be something we feel passionate for. You know, do we have a story to tell? Can we gel with that IP? And you know, is there a gap in our portfolio for it? There's no point putting yet another game out that's exactly like the last one, because you'll either just, you know, upset the guys that are currently involved in your current one, or you know. So there's lots going on to it, and it takes ages, years and years from conversation to a satisfying good product. And every time we've ever rushed it or not taken it seriously, or I've seen other people do that, the results are usually pretty unsatisfactory.
You mentioned Alessio a bit earlier on, and obviously River Horse have some cool licenses. So what was the kind of agreement with River Horse? I think it was the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, so Alessio, we'd always worked with him. He wrote Kings of War for us. You know, I think he'd always had that. I don't think the Warhammer game ever got a new edition. You know, I think 40K is on its third proper edition, where they've thrown all the characters and everything in the bin and started again. And you know, I remember in 96, Rick, 95 when Rick wrote it, playing that second edition of 40K. And it was genuinely a new game. He applied all he'd learned. And I think, you know, Warhammer, when I was running the studio for a while, it was like, can we move from ranks of 4 to 5? Because it just makes more. And, you know, they were very precious about it. And anyway, we got that one through. But that was, I think, the addition change. The big news was, now your ranks are 5, not 4. And but it never had that, like, just clean rewrite. And what Alessio did, because by this point he's a seasoned rules writer, he's been doing it 15 years, you know, at the very best. And he comes in and he kind of, I said, I want some clean, neat, fun rules to go with models. And he went, okay, I just kind of wrote it. He just clearly had it in his head, and it dropped out. And, you know, 15 years later, it's still going strong. It's great fun. It's fast. It's slick. It's clean. And it's playable for 2000 points and 5,000 points and 20,000 points. And you know, if you come to Adepticon, you see Blake and Kyle playing those huge battles, and they're taking people who've never played before, putting 20,000 points on a table, and 3 hours later, you know, there's a clear winner or loser. So, sorry, I got distracted there. But yeah, so that was Alessio. We'd always kind of stayed in touch and worked on stuff. And then he kind of had a penchant for running his own company. Sorry, the cat's joining me. He had a go, and I think he did the Terminator license, and he did the Hunger Games, and he was going into some of those kind of more board game rather than miniature game licenses, where they had minis, but it wasn't the central aspect of it. And they were doing a good job. But he's suddenly finding himself spending less and less time writing rules and more time chasing licenses, dealing with suppliers, dealing with customers, and so on and so forth. And I think by the middle of last year, I think he just had enough. He had Ghost in the Shell that he wanted to work on. He had Labyrinth, which, you know, he loves all the Henson IPs, but he didn't want to spend ages and ages sending out invoices and doing this kind of thing, or managing staff and doing that. And so we were at a scale size where we had people doing all of those types of things, and we could therefore free him up to do all of the rules writing that he wanted to do. And so that's become a match made in heaven. So we just, you know, bought his stock, took on the IPs, agreed that the IPs would work with Mantic and with him. And now we've got Ghost in the Shell in development, which is going to be a fun RPG that he's working up. And then he's been free because he's not doing all that other stuff. He's helped us hugely with Epic. Mm-hmm. And he's working on other future projects with us because he's now enjoying writing rules all day. And so... Mm-hmm. Free of the shackles of the administration, he's got back doing what he wants to do, and we've got access to a tier one war games, well, the best in the business rules writer, I think.
It's great to see somebody like Alessio be able to just do that, like do what he's best at, do what he's world class at. You know, it's such a waste if he's, like you say, sending out invoices and that, isn't it? On the flip side, like talking about yourself, like you obviously wear many hats and run the business. Now, how much time do you actually get to dedicate to getting involved in like rules writing and stuff like that?
I mean, usually with most projects, I like getting things started, and I'm not terribly good at the detail. So I love talking to the licensor in that period or when we're designing a new concept. And we've always got more ideas than we can do. And so it's a case of which of the 10 ideas are the ones that feel right to do next. You know, Dreadball is something that absolutely loved. I think it's a fantastic game. As a miniatures board game, I don't think there's one better out there. And then between just too many teams and a bit of bloat, and it, you know, they go through natural license. But it's something I've been looking to bring back for ages. It's been there, but it just never felt right. We couldn't work a new angle on it that felt fresh and felt exciting and invigorated it. So that's an example where it sits there in there. And then one day someone says, what about this? And how about that way? And then another very cool thing that we haven't yet revealed, but will be coming out soon, happened. And those things aligned and we went, okay, Dreadball All-Stars. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. And so in that stage, I'm all excited because I'm trying to just wait for the writer and the IP and the just to come together, and all of a sudden I can go, yeah, wow, yes, that's going to work. That's going to be cool as anything. That's going to get people excited. And then I go, right, let's go sculpting, let's go doing, and then I'll kind of just sit in. But the team now, we've got a full studio team who are very, very good at writing and testing, and we have playtesting days. I get one, if it's a new game, like Epic when we did that last year, I got a very early game with Matt and Alessio, and I just go, yep, that feels very Mantic. We call it Mantic. Does it feel clean? Are the rules written in a straightforward way? Because I think the hardest part of a game is learning the first two games, where you're going, well, how does that move? What does that do? Does it feel like if I've learnt it, I can layer up, learnt it, layer up. Okay, I've got the hang of this. I might not know exactly what that weapon does, but I know rough. And does it feel intuitive? If I've got big cannons, a big row of battery of cannons across the back of the battlefield, do they go and pound something with a risk of missing? But if they hit, it's going to hurt, you know? And the closer you are, the more likely I am to hit. Does it work like that? Yeah, that feels intuitive. That feels right. Let's play. So as long as I do the field test, and then they do all of the balancing, all the hard work of making sure the points are right and this isn't, you know, they don't move too far or too fast, and they spend ages balancing that and making sure it's rare and points, and rules committees will work with us, play testers will work with us, because everything goes through a rigorous process before it hits. And then I just swan around at the end and take all the glory and pretend I did it all, and, you know, it was all me. But, yeah, the real hard work gets done by the guys and girls inside it. I do have my – I do get excited about things. You know, like Halo's got me excited because I love Dead Zone. I love Dead Zone. It was a really playable game. And now I love Halo even more because it's even easier and an old man like me can remember it. Champions has got me, which is our little mini skirmish game coming up for Kings of War. It's a champion and a couple of units. So we did a game called Ambush, which was low points of Kings of War a couple of years ago. Just get 700 points, get 500 points. And that was really a fun way of playing like three games in a day if you don't feel like a big game or trying a different army. But it lacked, I think, just a little bit. What makes Kings of War great is at 2,000 points, you've got a hero, you've got war machines, you've got cavalry, You've got a 6x4. You've got the visual aspects of the whole thing. So what we did with Champions and Rob Berman, who's a big Mantic man, got some champions and then built a game around a champ and his retinue. But it is still a mini rank and flank game. You are still putting your troops on regiments. The heroes are absolutely spectacular. We've got this new master-crafted resin that we've worked with a partner to develop, which are just stunning. Glue your models together. But now your champion gives out some commands. Right, you guys hold. You guys attack stronger. You do this. So your champion is the thing that moves everything around. So there's a lot more character in the smaller game. And we've done things like there is no army building in it. You buy the box, you build the box, you paint the box, you play the box. So if you want it, and then suddenly if someone wants to play with their gaming club and introduce more to Kings of War, we're not introducing to a slightly bland, watered-down version of the 2,000-point game. We're introducing to a fun, characterful version of a X-points game, and all the packs are even. So as a hobby project, you could build one and I could build one, or someone could build two or three and then take them down to the club and say, right, which flavour do you want? I'll take Abyssals, I'll take Basileans, I'll take Goblins. Great. Here's the hero you're playing. Here's how he behaves. You know, and they've got a real character. The Goblin's stolen some dwarven steam-powered armour, so he's like a tooled-up gobbo. There's a full backstory. And so we're able to just really start having fun with little campaigns, and all through trade. You know, this isn't a Kickstarter. This is, you know, we're really trying to work with our trade partners and get our products onto shelves so people can, you know, find out what we're doing. And so I forgot the question now.
Well, you've talked a wee bit about this already, but with your own stable of IPs, like your own games, is there a general Mantic community that plays everything, or are these very segmented into the individual IPs?
So I think there is definitely some Mantic fans that sit at the heart of what we do, that just have been with us through the whole journey. You know, and there's some thousands of those in the US and in the UK that saw our kind of plight to democratize, you know, toy soldier gaming and be something a bit different and something a bit unique. And I think they've been with us the whole way. And then we've probably got game fanatics. That's what we call them, Mantic fanatics. And we've got people who love that particular game, Dead Zone, probably Halo now developing, Kings of War certainly, big crowd that love Kings of War. They're quite like Mantic, but love Kings of War. Kings of War is their game. And then I think we're then getting, particularly with products like, with games like Halo, we're getting out to a whole new audience that have no idea who we are. They don't know what we are. They love Halo. They play miniature gaming, and they just want to, you know, participate in this hobby that we have. And that's, you know, it's quite fun. We had a little mini tournament of 22 people for Halo, which, you know, 22 people after it's been on sale for 6 weeks is unheard of, because normally you've not really taken the shrink wrap off it, never mind built everything, played it enough times that you feel comfortable to go to a tournament. But we've done that. And I didn't recognise very many of them. You know, and people were all telling me their story about how they got into it, and it was all different, and not a lot of them were Mantic fans, which was great, because they're now playing a Mantic game, and then they go, what else have we got? Oh, Champions. Oh, Dead Zone. You know, and it's similar but different. You know, Dead Zone is a far more nuanced game than Halo. You know, in Halo, I shoot you, you die, I get a victory point, you respawn. And so the game is always balanced. We've always got the same armies. Whereas in Dead Zone, you pull a good maneuver off, you drop a grenade on something, or you make a mistake and I take advantage of it, I've now just killed three of your guys and that's a third of your force. You're going to struggle to recover from that. So, you know, unless you've got a plan that drew me out and therefore it's a cut and thrust, you know, a peace exchange, points exchange game. But You know how to move. You know how to shoot. You know how the tiles work. You know how the stat line works. So you've got already the basics. And then you go, oh, well, I like that one for playing with more casual gamers, and I like this one for a more committed experience.
What do you find yourself playing the most at the moment, and how much time do you actually get to play, especially without that metaphorical work hat on?
Yeah, and that's fun. So sometimes, you know, at the moment we're just playtesting Assassin's Creed. So it's a little board game we've got. Again, this is one where we're finding licenses, and there is some amazing visuals in it, but it didn't naturally lead itself to a miniatures game because you've got all the different eras, and I think the miniatures game was done when Triton Noir did their Venice one. I think that was the most characterful IP part of the thing. But there's just like so many timelines that you can pop into. So we're developing a board game that you can access all the different timelines, and then you play competitively in that space. So, you know, it's quite good fun because it looks like work, but at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, Jack will come in and he'll set a game up and we'll all play. And so those are, it's not lessened by the fact it's playtesting for work, you know, and this is it. I do it in the very early stages when we're, you know, is there a game here? Because it's not fun. You can't ask people to come to playtest day when you're doing that, because it's not a game you can play at that stage. It's very much a work in progress. I've been playing Halo. I like Halo. I'm playing that a lot. And like I said, I just had a Champions moment when I saw these new Mastercrafted resins and the I wanted to do this basing, you know, where you get ice. So the Northern Alliance are kind of up in the cold steeps, and so I'm going to do that resin with ice in it, and you know, so. But doing a whole army of it felt intimidating. But doing three units, I think, yeah, okay, I can cope with that. So, you know, it's nice when you can just switch off and just paint the minis. Do I usually end up getting them early and then going, you know, oh, thinking about work while I'm doing it? Yes, sometimes. So you need to find yourself in a happy spot. Like Worms is the other one I've been playing, because actually, you know, you can pop it out and play it with non-gamers and it feels like a board game experience. So, yeah, I get it. Playing five games of Kings of War over a weekend, you know, so you finish working on Friday night and then do that for 5 days and then do it for five times and then start again on Monday. That's when it gets tough. You know, I love demoing, going over to Adepticon and Salute and running demos and playing games. Great fun, because we're talking about it and I'm passionate about it. But yes, you have slots that you can play.
You mentioned painting there. How often do you actually paint?
Rarely, occasionally. I mean, you need something to, like anything, like, you know, we all find that the 2 weeks before a tournament, all of a sudden our painting urges go through the roof. And then coming after the tournament, you think, oh, I need to get painting. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, a month later, you painted nothing. So when Halo was coming out and the models were coming down the line, I was running home with them and painting them. And it was great fun. Why? Well, because I wanted to, you know, and I wanted to see what they looked like on paint. So I had a work hat on, kind of, but I actually just wanted to paint them. And with Champions, well, I know the plastic's good because it's all good plastics. I've seen the models. I'm doing it because it still has that same therapeutic, enjoyable and satisfying feelings that it did when I was 13 years old. You know, you can't see it. And I was going to turn my camera around, but on my, you know, shelf over there, it's all very dark. You know, I've got my, actually, I haven't got my Kings of War army. Because I've got my Walking Dead, my Kings of War army's in the office. And, you know, it's a nice 4,000-point dwarf army. And I love it. You know, I think we all have a real sense of satisfaction when we've painted an army and it becomes ours and it goes on our shelves.
Thinking about, you know, the evolution of Mantic and the growth over the years, there must have been a few really difficult times in that period. Like, what are some of the biggest obstacles you had to overcome, and even some of the you know, looking back, the some of the biggest mistakes you might have felt you made?
Yeah, fair question. And it is, I mean, at the time Mantic was set up, GW was on that price rises every 6 months, and there was quite a lot of, like, grumpiness about the way they were handling things. And so I thought, great, I'm going to go and set up Mantic, and then everyone will just flock to that flag. Yeah, it took a while. I think it was Ben Clapperton that came to the very first event at Maelstrom Games up in Mansfield, and they had an event. And there was four of us went down there, and one person turned up. It was Ben. So there was that moment when you went, "Oh my goodness, okay, maybe." You know, 30 years of hard work and dedication and a lot of passion from a lot of people and being a pioneer in the industry means that, and so you, I think we had to reassess what we were capable of and where we were going to go and how we were going to do it. And that's still an evolutionary process. I think as soon as you think, oh, we're this, you'll miss that the landscape's constantly changing. I think it's a bit like, you know, when I went to some, you know, like business conversations or something in the early 2000s, and at the time Microsoft dominated personal computers, dominated work computers, Office, and everything else. The internet was coming, but it wasn't there in the ubiquitous way it is now. And if I said in that room that Apple was going to be not only the biggest company in the world, but it was going to do it through hardware sales, I'd have got laughed out of the room. And that Amazon, and I remember one of our teachers saying, oh, Amazon, I mean, they've branched out from books into DVDs or something. What a ridiculous move that is. They should stick to their knitting. What do they know? And I'd have said, no, actually, mate, that's going to be the third biggest company in the world. And it's going to be done in the world of computers, you know, the way that we interact with things, because Microsoft owned all that. And so I think we're now living in a time where the RPG industry is an industry. The miniature gaming world is an industry. Board games are an industry. And the lines between them are blurring. And I think Mantic has to adapt if he wants to be one of the biggest players in the miniature wargaming space, which is where I see us living. We do board games, they're fun, but they usually have a fantasy sci-fi element and they usually have miniatures. but our core heart is, and I said to someone, if you take that Halo, four figures, card terrain, 2x2 mats, but troops, gaming table, dice, and epic, which we did early last year, which is, you know, eight hard plastic armies in 8mm, 10mm, whatever size they finalized on, with hundreds of tanks, artillery, flyers on a 6x4. I think that's probably as hardcore as a miniature we're going to get. We're never going to go to hex, you know, based tiles. We want miniatures. We want them to be visual. And Halo is probably, and between those two points is where Mantic lives. The heart of Mantic is somewhere in the middle. We dabble outside. Worms lives just outside that. Probably DSO lives just outside that. They're dungeon crawlers, but they're games we want to make. They're people we want to talk to. We want to get our miniatures in their hands and show, look, this is a barbarian. This is an elf ranger, and these are the type of games we make. Do you want to have a look at Champions? But I think, you know, the core, and so we've just got to adapt and how people want to participate in that. You know, we've started doing STLs with the Vault. So people, for two reasons, I think you can't get to a gaming store. You live in Argentina and you can't buy minis. It's difficult to import them. So here you are. I'm going to get a print and I'm going to print them. And we want people to play our games. And similarly, some people want to, you know, chunk them out in huge numbers. So Armada was a classic game. We did it during lockdown. Wonderful fantasy naval game. Very visual, wonderful sculpts and models. Very, very lovely to paint. Once lockdowns ended, you know, we launched it into retail stores. Well, we'd launched it into retail stores. They'd done very, very well with it. We were casting the heck out of it because we couldn't get any plastics done at the time. Great fun. But it was coming to a kind of end as a retail product. People, you know, people in retail want the new hotness. What's hot now? What's hot now? But, it's too good to just go off and die. So we put it on the Vault. And now the number of people that come up to me and go, I'd always kind of thought about Armada, but I hadn't quite taken the jump, but now I can print the ships. Me and my son are playing every weekend. We absolutely love it. It's a great game. We're having great fun with it. Well, there you go. If I'm doing that, I'm doing my job. If people are having fun with what we're doing, they're enjoying our games, they're enjoying the miniatures, they're having fun, then Mantic's achieving what it's setting out to do.
Our question of the month for March 2025 is, what's the coolest bit of terrain you've ever built? And bonus points for the unlikely source material too. Get your audio clip in over at bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and I need them in by Friday the 28th of March. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and now back to the show. What can people expect from Mantic in the next few weeks, in the next few months then?
Well, yes, I mean, show season starts next week, and the announcement comes out tomorrow. I'm recording this, which should be out, but we've got a raft of releases to support Halo. The second wave is just landing, and this is where we're putting out points, because a guy, a Spartan with a grav hammer, is tougher than a guy with a bulldog. So you're going to need to start. So now you can either take four guys and tool one of them up, or you can take three guys and tool a couple of them up, or you can take, you know, four guys with a whole load of equipment. And so you can really start shaping your squad and having fun with it and taking the game onto the army building levels. But it's still Spartan v Spartan. So it's not gone infinitely complicated too early. We've got some, you know, I was talking about this mastercrafted resin. We've got some of the original Spartans from the Recon edition re-sculpted. So if you're a painter of the top level, or you just want, you know, the best models money can buy, this is them. And it's a slightly better material than resin. We found this new material. It's a special, slightly more plasticky resin. It's got a little more bend in it, a little more detail in it. Champions is launching. This is that hero-centric Kings of War game set in the world of Panathor. And Adepticon, we've got a very big announcement for maybe what's coming next for Halo. And it's a brutal announcement. And then, of course, we've got the Epic Kickstarter is going to be delivering around June time. And the plastics for that are looking stunning. And this, again, is going to be one of our first coordinated releases. And by that, I mean plastics are coming out. But you could either pay us to make your, so if you, your core armor's in plastic, you're going to get, you know, 80% of everything you need there. But the other 20%, you could either pay us and we'd make it in resin, or you can just buy the STL and you can print it yourself. So if you want hundreds of those, you know, go down the STL route. If you want the convenience of us casting it for you, we'll do it for you. And so, you know, because we really want to embrace and engage with that community and say, hey guys, we know you kind of print your miniatures and that's what you enjoy doing. So we want you to play our games. We want you to try our games. So here's the rule set. And that worked really well with Armada. You know, that went on Frontiers, and another number of people that hadn't seen it or hadn't heard of Mantic went, participated and signed up. And so, you know, the future is that we want people to give our game a try, whether it's a four-man Spartan team or a 10,000-point epic scale game, come join us.
Where's the best place for the listener to keep up with all the goings-on at Mantic?
Well, I'm a bit old school. We keep trying to do a podcast, but we always fail. So, I mean, I think the newsletter, if you hit the Mantic Games newsletter, we usually have two a week. The Wednesday one is more hobby-orientated activities, events, things that are going on, the blogs that have gone out with tactics and things like that. And then the Friday one is new releases, new products, new videos, the big drops. You know, obviously Mantic HQ is always open. It's open 7 days a week. You can pop up there. We have open days. We go to all the events and shows. So Tobias over in the UK and Rick and his team of Pathfinders in the US. And I'm always available for bar mitzvahs, weddings, and any podcasts that I get invited on. But I think the newsletter is probably the best way to keep up to speed. www.manticgames.com, and get a sign up in there. But there's tons of information. Go and have a look at the website and decide where you want to go.
Brilliant. Well, I really appreciate your time, Ronnie, and it's been great to catch up on all of this. And I'm sure it won't be the last time we'll speak. If you would come on again, that'd be brilliant.
I would love to. That'd be great, Matthew, and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.